Calling all benders and non-benders alike. Jump into the epic world of Avatar with your favorite podcast, Avatar Braving the Elements. Hosted by me, Janet Varney.
And me, Dante Bosco. Each week we'll recap and discuss a new episode.
So come join us and our amazing guests, from creators to cast to superfans, to chat about all things Avatarverse.
It's Fire Nation time. Book of Fire. Let's go. Listen to Avatar Braving the Elements
wherever you get your podcasts.
What is up, everybody? Welcome to Comic Book Club. I'm Alex.
I'm Justin.
I'm Pete.
And we're coming to you from a couple of different places on the internet. We're live on YouTube. We're live on Crowdcast. Maybe you're listening to us later on Audioly or Soundify. Or
maybe you're in a post-apocalyptic situation where this has been pressed on vinyl, and it's, you've built a cult or tribe around the idea of these recordings, and there's a series of Justins, Alex, and Pete that are doing battle for domination over the post-apocalyptic universe.
Oh, boy.
Let's hope that's not happening.
Yeah, that would be terrible. But what is not terrible is the show that we have for you all tonight.
Let's hope so.
I mean, we'll see what happens. Right. I feel like I've been lost in a maze of my own thoughts.
Did you see what you did there?
Okay.
And that is a good tee up for our first guest here. We're going to bring him into the stream. He is the creator of Marvel Mazes, a new book that you could probably figure out from Chronicle Books. Ladies and gentlemen, Sean Jackson, hello.
Hey. Hello.
How are you? Hello. Sean, thank you so much for joining this evening. I'm very excited to talk about this book. As I mentioned, it's out from Chronicle Books, I believe, right now. And you can get it anywhere, right?
You can get it anywhere. Yes, you can check out your local bookstore first, obviously. You can get it on bookshop.org, Amazon, of course. And pretty much anywhere you can get a book.
Nice. Well, let's, again, people can figure out what the concept is just based on the title of it, but it's so cool and whimsical the way that it's laid out with the mazes. You have this great stuff in the Marvel Universe. You have all these little Easter eggs and things that people can find. So it's not just about solving the mazes. It's about doing a little bit of a scavenger hunt, I guess you would say, as well. But I was reading, I think it was in the back matter in your bio, you say you've always been obsessed with mazes. Why the obsession? What draws you to them in general?
I sort of got obsessed when I was a kid. There was an artist I liked who did these three-dimensional mazes that I just obsessed over and just kind of copied and did perspective style mazes, and was really into doing that when I was younger. And just it became sort of a doodle form, doing it all along. And really just in the last maybe 10 years or so, it's sort of taken on its own life where I've really other people have paid attention, it's like other people enjoy it as much as I do. So it's just great to share them with people.
It's so satisfying to look at this book. It is just, it takes me back to being a kid. It makes me want to get like a pencil maybe that I can erase so I can do it in pen where I don't mess up any, you know what I mean?
You got to commit. Really? You got to go with the
child
pen,
perfectionist.
Bro.
You are, how many scribble outs do you have in a maze? It's a piece of art. You got to get it right.
Well, wait. Sean, can you settle this, actually? Are you a pencil guy or a pen guy when it comes to mazes?
I'm a big fan of not using either. I just use the end of my finger or something pointy that doesn't draw on the book, because I go back and do them again and again. I just, they just become familiar and like old time revisiting them. So I just, I don't draw on the book. If you got to draw on them, maybe make a photocopy or buy a couple
this
more
is
books.
A professional maze.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Like, you buy one comic, to keep, it'll hold the pristine, another you can draw on follow the mazes.
When I was a kid, there was this show on PBS called The Secret City or something like this. And it was like, it wasn't mazes, but this guy would draw these massive cities and like alien planets and stuff, and this book just triggered me back to watching this guy for hours do it. And it's such a satisfying just going through the different little pieces, the different corners you've built into all these mazes.
I love adding little bits and stuff, especially with the Marvel book. I can do the research and read the comics and be like, oh, this would be cool to add, and I know that somebody out there's going to be like, oh yeah, I remember that, I know what that's about. And then just filling in the spaces is this really, it's really fun to do the little details.
Well, you have so many different locations here in the book. I mean, for those who are watching the live stream right now, we're checking out. You got one of Shuri's lab. There's all most of the major locations I think you'd expect. But how did you whittle it down to the list of what would actually work as a maze?
Well, I definitely wanted to keep it. You know, I kept, even though the books, the mazes are based on the comics, you know, I kept it with the heroes we're familiar with from the MCU. And then we've got some X-Men in there and Spider-Man, you know, and those guys as well. But for the most part, I really wanted to keep it the mainstream folks or folks that we've been introduced to. As far as locations, some of them came up right away. As soon as I started doing research, I knew I wanted to do, you know, Planet Hawk, because it's just a cool story and a cool location. There's a lot of neat stuff going on there. I got sucked into Ms. Marvel right away, and I thought it would be fun to do, you know, I knew I was going to do Asgard. I knew I was going to do all these really great Marvel places. And I was like, okay, well, we got to put Jersey City in there just because it's hysterical, you know? So, and when I got around and read the books, I'm like, this is a good story. This is a great new hero. And so that was fun to do as well. So after like finding the first couple, I kind of worked with my editor. I knew I want to do, you know, I knew I want to do the Iron Man cave, you know, the Tony Stark cave. That was a pretty given one. And so the longer I went, like this one, I wasn't sure. I knew I wanted to do some sort of Avengers. I went back and read the Kree-Skrull War. I was like, okay, this ship is perfect. It's, you know, laid out, and it really gave us something to get all classic Avengers together, you know, in space. So it was fun.
Is there one location that you couldn't get in that you were like, it was right on the edge? So you're like, it's just not quite maze worthy.
There were some, I guess there are stories out there that didn't quite fit. But by the time we got to like, even like Marvel Zombies, I didn't know what I was going to do, you know? And then when I read the book, this again, a great story, just busted up town, throw a bunch of zombies in there.
Oh my God.
Worked. This was fun. This was just, again, I've drawn these kind of planet-y mazes. So this is Ego, by the way.
Yeah.
If you're listening. Yeah. So doing Ego, he's such a bonkers character in the comics. It's like so weird and so awesome. And I have drawn planet style mazes before, and this just seemed like a great mesh to combine the two. And it's not really from a particular story, it just seemed fun. And like a lot of the artists have just done their own fan art of this. It's like, okay, there's a lot to work with here.
I love that Ego doesn't give a lot of hot takes or emotions often when we see him in the comics, but this Ego is giving us a level of side eye that I haven't seen enough people, besides Pete LePage here in the chat.
Well, I'm curious to hear, I mean, maybe using this one as an example, I don't know if this is the best one, but just to throw it out there, taking a big step back, what do you start with? Do you start with laying out the maze? Do you start with the picture and then maze over it? How does it all come together?
Some of it depends. A lot of times when I'm just creating a maze without a specific landscape, you know, without a specific location, I'll just doodle right across the page, you know, little buildings and paths and steps and bridges, and it just becomes a maze. And that's part of the plan. For something like this, I certainly sketched out, okay, this is, you know, I found a couple references of the Egos I liked. I sketched him out in my sketchbook. So, I drew the maze around his face, you know, inside the circle. Like for Shiri's lab there, because it has such a strong perspective, like a real 3D perspective, that I built my grid for the perspective and then drew the maze inside here. So it's required the perspective lines, but I did start at the start and at the end. So I kind of knew I wanted to start with Storm floating in the window. She does that. I knew I wanted the garage because Shuri's garage plays, you know, at least in this storyline, a big part of it, her tech stuff. And of course I love the lab in the film, and then they bring a little bit of that into the comics too. And then it's just a neat story. And then so for like some of the stuff, like some of the gear in here, I just like, well, she'll probably have this, you know, she'll probably have the flight simulator and a telescope. And what else would you have as a scientist? And there's like, you know, you know, all her energy making stuff.
So I first I gotta apologize because once the mazes went up, I kind of zoned you guys out and have been trying to solve the maze the whole time.
Wow.
But I did hear you say that like you start at the start and end at the end. Does that mean you start with the correct path and then kind of add all the incorrect ones? Or do you just kind of like start the maze and let the kind of correct path to come to you? How do you do that?
I definitely let the correct path come to me. So I build it and then build my branches going out and we'll decide which one is the most tricky to find for me, just kind of flow wise. And that becomes the path to go to. Sometimes I want to make sure I get to different parts of the maze, you know, following the path. But even then, you know, the dead ends will go out and wind up somewhere interesting or loop back. But yeah, the maze is built as I draw.
Oh, wow. Is there a double black diamond in here? Something that's like, this one's really going to mess with the people at home.
In the book, they start easier and then they get harder through the book. So it's the ones towards the end of the book are the hardest.
Have you ever like finished in maze that you thought was beautiful, but then you were like, ah, it's too easy?
Oh, yes. All the time.
Oh, wow.
Some of these interior ones, like even maybe not Doctor Strange, the Sanctum so much, but some of the interior ones I found really simple, you know, like the Hawkeye maze, I think is really fun. I think it's very simple. This one, I think, is as tricky as it looks.
Awesome. Oh, yeah. This one is.
Yeah, for those listening, this is a Devourer of Worlds. It's Galactus, and you got the Watcher here and some outer space. This looks fantastic for going throughout. It's very trippy and awesome. You've also got, as I mentioned before, these little extra scavenger hunty things. When you're doing something like that, is that something you do later? Do you sort of draw and lay out the whole thing and then decide, oh, okay, these pieces would be good for a scavenger hunt, or does it come at a different time?
Those are usually added later. Depending on the story, like for all of these, once I realize I'm going to put an ultimate nullifier in all the mazes, so that gets added. You know, there's one of those in every single maze. Sometimes the findables are really simple, just like some of the characters who are here in the maze. Sometimes there'll be like a little device or something that I drew just in my doodles. Like, okay, that's something that's worth finding, you know, like a little sculpture or something that kind of came out as I was creating. And then there's a lot of classics that I throw in mazes, like I have a little pots that I like and little like technical stuff. Here, this is Sakaar with Planet Hawk. In this actual storyline, there's like these floating jellyfish creatures in the air from the comics. I was like, okay, that's a good findable. And there's a couple of those in here, that kind of stuff.
Do you ever get lost in your own maze where you're just kind of like so detailed, you're kind of like, oh my God, what did I do?
I when I'm creating them, sometimes I'll be like, what have I got myself into? Either because the challenge is too hard. And sometimes I go back and I'm like, okay, this is trickier than I remember. So
I feel like this is the kind of thing that you work on this book and then you finish and then you're walking through your neighborhood and you're just seeing a dog maze, a barista maze, everything's a maze.
Yes, that happens all the time. So
I played Dr. Mario too much in college and would see pills dropping in my front of my vision.
Exactly. Recently, I've been playing a lot of Control, and so I was like, okay, now I'm thinking all these brutalist mazes that I have to, you know, I'll do my Control fan art maze.
We have a question from the comments from Edward Doherty. Did you include a Jim Steranko metaphysical maze?
There's no metaphysical maze. No, the last maze in the book is a teleport maze. It's a Spider-Verse maze. So you bounce around all the worlds they did in the Spider-Verse stories. And that one's tricky because there are teleports you find and they take you to dead ends and that kind of stuff. So that was probably the trickiest maze. That was really fun and had a lot of detail, a lot of research in that one. And then I think the Doctor Strange one that, you know, the left half is the Sanctum and then the right half just kind of goes into all different angles and stuff, more Escher-y. And I think that turned out pretty cool too.
Do you seek out like real mazes in real life? Like, do you go to corn mazes?
I have never been to a corn maze.
What? You would love it. It's like a maze.
How about Maze Mania down in South Carolina? You ever been to that one? Oh man, it's crazy. You got
your full Chris Farley mode right now. This maze book has got you.
Yeah, this is
Well, so you've done beyond just general mazes. You've done this Marvel maze book. You did a Star Wars maze book as well. Is there another franchise you have your eyes on in particular?
Oh, that's awesome.
Or one that might lend itself to mazes?
Well, I'd probably jump into pretty much anything. I mean, one of the advantages of the Star Wars and the Marvel is I love Star Wars and I love Marvel. So they're real, you know, easy guests for me. I could do, you know, I'd do a Pixar maze. That would be fun. A big Pixar fan. So,
Kevin suggests Doctor Who mazes. Would that work?
That would work. I could do Doctor Who, you know, that would be fun. I mean, I definitely, and again, Doctor Who is like, I definitely had my period of when I was really into Doctor Who, you know, so anything outside of that, kind of like the other ones, you know, it would definitely involve the research. And I love doing the research. I love really digging into these fandoms. It's just, there's so much out there that I learn all the time when I, you know, get into these books. So,
yeah. And do you think, if this one is super successful, is there enough there to do a Marvel Mazes 2 potentially?
Oh, definitely. I've already listed all the locations that I would want to do if I had to do it. You know, I definitely would want to do like Galactus, a spaceship. Beta Ray Bill's spaceship would be cool.
Oh, yeah.
Intergalactic Wakanda would be cool. So there's a lot of things like on the horizon that I could start working up.
Savage Land.
We had another great question. Edward Doherty asked, what is your favorite mazes from movies like The Shining?
Obviously, Labyrinth was fantastic. You know, they just did a lot of neat tricks in there, and winding up with the Escher was pretty cool. I don't know if you guys have seen Werewolf by Night yet, but that was so sweet when they pulled the camera up and you looked into the garden and they had the maze. And they, that's for me, you know. And show was so perfect. So that kind of stuff.
I love that. Awesome. Sean, this is so cool. This is such a great book.
It really is.
And it's on bookstores everywhere, right? You can get it anywhere at this point.
Bookstores everywhere, you know. And if your local store doesn't have it, ask them; they can order it for you. And of course, any online retailer.
Amazing, Sean, thank you so much for coming on. This is so cool. I can't wait to give this to my kids. I already sold my son on a copy earlier today, so you've sold at least one more tonight. So
yeah, I want it on my wall.
I was looking at your original art is also a really amazing. I would worry about if I bought it, though, because I'd want to write on it. But it's also really cool to check out.
Oh, yeah, Pete actually owns the Mona Lisa, and he did the same thing. He drew all over it.
He's a big soup thrower.
All right, Sean, have a good night. Good talking to you.
Thank you again. Appreciate it. Sean. Have a good one.
All right, there we go. Once again, the book is called Marvel Mazes. It's from Chronicle Books. And if you're only listening, I know it's probably hard to get a sense of it. These are so cool, and the drawing is so cute is probably the wrong word, but it's very adorable mazes at the same time while being good for both kids and adults. It's great stuff.
Also, it's a
kit as well.
Even though it looks huge, it's still inviting. It's not like, oh, fuck, I'd never get this. There's something accessible about it that...
It's not like the menu at IHOP, right, Pete? Like, you get in there and you're like, I can't do this. This is too much. What are these word jumbles? No thanks.
Oh, wow, dude.
I mean, I think we finally found the... Pete was so excited during the interview. Like, the comic that has no words. It's the maze.
But like you, Justin,
it's still sort of an adventure.
Yeah, seeing that thing makes me just kind of want to like grab a flashlight, jump in my bed, and try to just kind of like, you know, sit there for hours and have fun. Like there's the comfort feel to it is really amazing.
Solvable problems. That's what it's all
about. Yeah, solvable problems. That's what you need.
Hey, here's another solvable problem. Who is our next guest?
just for those of you listening,
I got caught in a maze of my own thoughts again. Anyway, I'm going to invite him in here. He is a creator of The Whistling Skull, which is finally coming back thanks to Zoop very soon. He's also worked on a ton of other things that you probably know and love that we'll probably talk about. B. Clay Moore, everybody. Hello.
Hey. Hey, guys.
Welcome. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks.
Glad you guys saw me. Thank you for... Yes, we did see you. Thank you for coming in. Thank you for chatting about this. Very excited. So this is, we've had a bunch of Zoop creators on here, just as a reminder for anybody who is listening in for the first time. This is a curated crowdfunding platform. And the Whistling Skull, this is kind of a particularly interesting project, I think, because it's B. Claymore, who we have on, and Tony Harris.
Yep.
Hello. and the...
Okay.
Yes, this is a project that actually was published back in the day by DC as the JSA files, JSA Liberty files, the Whistling Skull, and now it's coming back at a collected edition. Talk to us a little bit about this. Why bring this back now, and why bring this back on Zoop?
Well, as you mentioned, it was originally published through DC. With DC elements included, even though those elements were Elseworlds elements, which is, for those who don't know, sort of like skewed reality, alternate reality versions of DC characters, was not originally intended or pitched with those included. It was a creator-owned thing in its own universe that had been approved long before we approved and written long before we added those elements. At the time, it was going to be published through Wildstorm, which is a DC imprint, or was a DC imprint, which was the problem because the imprint folded. And we knew that it would move over to DC proper, but wasn't sure what form that would take. So Tony Harris, the co-creator and the artist, suggested bringing in these Elseworlds elements from a book he had created years earlier with Dan Jolly. It had done very well and was popular, which I thought, sure, give it a shot. But I mean, this is like our own universe, a creator own book. That's not going to happen. And then it did. They said, okay. So so then we kind of remixed what we had then and added these JSA. And in fairness, of all the mainstream big two characters, probably the original JSA characters are my favorite characters.
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
I'm not even sure why, but the first, well, I mean, I know that, like, I know when I think I discovered them, like, I started reading comics and kind of discovered them. I say late in the game, but it was probably like 2 weeks after I started reading comics, and they were so.
I moved different back then.
Sure. Exactly, right.
When you're a new comic reader, it's like this, your brain is exploding every 20 minutes.
I know when I go back and actually figure out the time frame and all this stuff, it's, you know, I mean, 5 months worth of comics was like an entire lifetime as a kid.
Yeah.
But I had a friend who had these beat up back issues, and I remember he had a copy of one of the 70s All-Star Comics issues. And it was like, I mean, and at that time, this is, you know, pre-internet, pre just everything, you know, all the information at hand. I had no idea. So it kind of led me down a road. I became a big Golden Age fan after the fact. So I was in favor of the idea. Dan DiDio, Jim Lee, whoever made the decisions, greenlit it. So I had to remix it and include those already tweaked versions into the existing scripts. And then that's how it went out. And they retitled it. It was originally called The Further Adventures of the Whistling Skull, which was... Tony approached me initially with that title when he conceived the book. And I like the idea of a new character in a new book starting with The Further Adventures. Yeah. Although it had been announced as that before it was published, because it was approved in 2007 and wow. Didn't actually hit the stands until the very end of 2012. So it's been exactly a decade, and then 2013. But a lot of people, and I guess I should have seen this coming, but it seemed to confuse enough people that they were trying to figure out where the character had appeared before, since it was in a DC book, but, that's their problem. So that happened. And then, the way all of the creator owned stuff that DC through Vertigo, Wildstorm, whatever imprints they've had works is that, and really this is the only time that I'm aware of that they mixed in already owned DC elements into a creator owned book. So we had to kind of tweak the contracts a little bit because there's always a clause in there where you can regain the rights to the material you create. Publishing rights, media rights, everything, if certain conditions are met. So from day one, I was aware that if the rights came back to us at some point, we would want to do something with them. And then we'd have to deal with the fact that there were these DC elements mixed in. And the revised contracts basically said everything's the same, except you can't obviously use the DC. So those conditions were met. And originally, I should say, it was a 6-issue miniseries. And it launched pretty well in general market terms through some fault that had nothing to do with the book. It sort of got, and DC, not speaking so much about DC now, but DC at the time was kind of running through trying things. I don't even know how to, that was right around the New 52. And and as somebody who had been working on DC projects, it was very, let me put it this way, as a guy who was not like a core DC creator, but who did a lot of different DC projects, it was sort of a kind of shooting in the dark, trying to figure out what you might be able to do, be able to pitch, get to, where stuff was heading.
Well, that's what seems so crazy about this, because it feels like it was like, yeah, I guess we'll give this a shot. Like, it's such a unique sort of perfect storm of elements to come together. And it's like, because I have never heard of anything like this before.
Well, no, and off the top of my head, I can't think of any case where it's done. So really, the conditions that have to be met, I mean, it's not like a trade secret. Generally, it's sort of like if stuff goes out of print for a certain amount of time. And the contract was done 10 years ago, and that was right when Wildstorm, they collapsed. The Wildstorm branch kind of became the digital first branch for DC. Right. Because I had been close, I had previously worked for DC proper. I mean, the first thing I did actually was, this is if anybody's out there looking for career advice or what have you, this is a thing don't do. when DC first approached me about working for them, I'm sure, and it was, I was dealing directly with Dan DiDio, and Jan Jones was his assistant at the time. And he said, we've never told the story of how Batman met Detective Bullock. I had done Hawaiian Dick and some kind of stuff in that vein. He was like, that seems to be in your wheelhouse. Maybe you could tell this story in like a Legends of the Dark Knight thing. And he said, also, we need filler for the JSA classified book. And I was like, hey, let me go watch that story. and it was like the only time, like, you tell yourself something when you're coming up. And I was like, if I ever get a chance to do a JSA story, I'm doing it. So I think at the time I thought, I said I'd do it, so screw Batman. Who wants to read Batman stories?
Yeah. I just choose the two equally popular characters, Wildcat and Batman. No issues.
Yeah. I think that immediately put me on Dan's something wrong with squirrel brain list, which I was on for a long time. But
in fairness, so I did.
Yeah. So, but I did the Wildcat story, and the thing I'm grateful about it is that I was able to bring Ramon Perez in to draw it, who has since done, he did a book called Tale of Sand that won an Eisner. I mean, he's a brilliant artist, phenomenal. Yeah. But at the time, not because he hadn't, he probably could have done what he wanted to by then, but he's one of these Toronto guys who kind of always wanted to, they'll do what they want to do, I'd known it. So I proposed him as the artist on it, and they immediately said his art was a little too stylized, which again was kind of a Dan thing. So I was like, hey, Ramon, redraw the characters again. I knew that if he didn't get this gig, he wasn't going to, fret over it too much. So he did it, and they brought him in. Dave McKay did the color. And so, as an entry, as a first story at DC, I'm pretty proud of it. I think it reads really well. It was, Ramon killed it.
Yeah.
And anyway, but the point is that was so I, you know, my JSA fandom kind of led me in the wrong direction at DC. and so as a result at DC, and then we did this book, which Tony had approached me about, and I sort of got pigeonholed for a while as well for the whole time I was doing a lot of stuff there as kind of a retro, you know, what I, which is, it's fine. It's not fine. It's good to have the work and, you know, creating our own books are always kind of my, the thing that I'm most focused on. But I, you know, I think I pigeonholed myself. And this book probably didn't help in that regard, but because it's set in the '40s, JSA are characters. But it's at heart, it's kind of a pulp noir, weird, like weird in the classic sense, which
yeah,
like in the '40s, fifties, '30s, weird would have been a term that people identified as a specific genre more than anything, you know, I mean,
yeah. Like, and to define that, that'd be like gory, sort of sort of horror adjacent.
Exactly. Yeah.
Just for anybody who's never read it, and I'm obviously skipping over a lot of the book, but it's essentially like a drippy zombie guy who's driving in a car with a dude who is not Night Owl, but like looks a little bit like Night Owl, and going on adventures. And there's Nazis that are kind of fighting in the background. There's a lot of different stuff going on there, and it's very fun. And like you said, it's wild and weird at the same time. I was curious, this is a little bit more of a technical question, but now that you are revisiting it and you've got to excise material and put new material in, you're different as a writer now. Tony Harris is different as an artist now. And just on a very technical level, you got to take that original art and craft things in a different way. What's involved there in terms of pulling that stuff out and putting new stuff in?
Well, the advantage we had, excuse me, the advantage I had was that I had written it without those characters initially. Excuse me. So when it came time to mix those characters in, 6 issues, I didn't I didn't create a new story, basically. I took kind of the existing story, which was kind of designed to introduce the world that the character lived in, the tone, the overall feel. And so what we ended up kind of doing was using those JSA characters in sort of a framing sense and also as a way to conceptualize the larger world he was a part of. But what the other thing about it was that those characters we brought in were Elseworlds characters to begin with. So they were kind of already Tony's spin on existing DC characters, which we then spun back in. And so we had ideas for the larger world. And like we had conceptualized the idea that the Skull, first of all, he's a generational hero. So that's kind of key to the story, is that he's whatever number in line of Whistling Skulls. And the sidekick you mentioned is his sidekick, Nigel, who he has sort of looked after since they were boys, because Nigel's sort of developmentally slower. Nigel is intellectually, he's sort of stuck around the age of 9 or 10. So he's kind of
a new one like Nigel.
Yeah.
Yeah. My guy.
We thought comic readers would look up to him, but he's, he's kind of the heart of the story, but he's also, he kind of drives a lot of the action. I mean, we really didn't, you know, we didn't want to make him, we try to make him a realistic character with heart. And then the relationship between the two of them was strong before the other character became the Whistling Skull. Nigel's father was the previous Whistling Skull, and he had known this kind of street urchin who had looked after his son. But not in a way that was patronizing. He was his friend, and he knew that he wanted him, if anybody, to sort of help guide his son. So all of that stuff was in place. I knew that we would probably want a larger, since the rules of the universe we created are established in this series, which means it's reality adjacent, but it's pushed into the weirdness enough that there's, it's not crazy extreme, you know, magic stuff, but you mentioned the Nazi villains. There's a Nazi mad doctor kind of type again, very much a pulp 30s, 40s trope, you know, the mad doctor, I mean, you could go back, like people now would probably be surprised to go back and see some of the pulps of the 30s and 40s and how disturbing they are now to look at, you know, I mean, like the weird doctors weren't like, not like what you would have seen in movies at the time, which were censored a lot more. I mean, you know, they're draining blood from virgins and, you know, cutting off. I mean, it was so this character is one of those, except he happens to be a Nazi since it's World War II. And then he he's got this sort of group of what seem to be freaks that he travels with, but not, again, not real world freaks. I mean, they're a step beyond. Like one character seems to have malleable bones and is like, which in design terms, I was actually looking at the art again for the first time recently because it's been so long. And just what Tony did with these characters.
Yeah, it's awesome.
I mean, it's at the time Tony was coming off of Ex Machina with Brian K. Vaughan, which was very real world based. And he actually used his more photorealistic photo reference style. So when we started this, he abandoned that and kind of went in this stylized, exaggerated.
Cut a little loose.
Right. Which as a reader and generally, I kind of prefer stuff that's a little more stylized. Otherwise, you know, otherwise, why are you reading comics if you don't want to push the envelope a little bit? So
I love how you're very calmly and concisely describing some like trippy, fucked up images. Over there.
Well, they really are. And, dude, I'll tell you, I will say that it was, I mean, again, like you have, you know, you've got all this stuff you've done. I've got piles of shit I've written over the years. And and sometimes if it goes far enough back, you don't want to reread it. Because God knows, but usually when I do read the older stuff, I realize, okay, it works. But the Skull, I guess I haven't had a copy of the trade paperback forever. I've just had loose issues. So I, when I went back and read it, I was first struck by the art that Tony with Dave McKay doing color. It's just, I mean, I love it. I mean, like I legitimately looked at it and was like, if I hadn't written this book, I would have tried to find Tony and Dave and told them how fucking awesome and just the art was. It's so beautiful.
Agreed.
But yeah, it is definitely, there's a scene that I keep thinking of where Nigel is attacked by a snake and he's terribly afraid of snakes, which again, this is the kind of scene that helps illuminate Nigel's character, right? He's terrified. He's terrified of snakes, but his partner, William the Whistling Skull, is in danger and his concern shifts there. And there's this scene where Tony's shot is from above and he's ripping the snake in half with like snake bones and guts flying all over the place. And I keep looking at that because I'd almost forgotten it. And I'm like, that's just, I didn't write that. I mean, that's awesome, you know? So to answer the question that was asked before I rambled, it was, because we had kind of grafted those characters into what we had already had in mind, it wasn't that hard to remove them and kind of rework new characters and then sort of shift a little bit the it's the same basic their relationship to the Skull exists still with different characters and kind of a different perspective. So it was really a case of just kind of tweaking some existing artwork. And then I went back and re-scripted some of the sequences to not just to wash out the DC elements, but to sort of reestablish our own Skull universe. Because we'd love to, we originally intended to do like 40 issues.
Oh, wow.
Because I said it was generational. We wanted to tell the story from beginning to end of this Whistling Skull, like from where he starts to where he ends. So we have story in mind, you know, places to go. And because it's a generational hero, there's, you know, you can go back and tell stories of previous Skulls or future Skulls.
Just to talk about the Zoop of it all. So it's not, for anybody who's listening, it's not live on Zoop yet. First of all, do you have a timeline for that?
It was going to go live today, but one of the kind of things that we talked to about Zoop from day one was that we're not, which they were proponents of, and we were like, we're not going to go live until we have all the elements in hand. Actually, all the work, the book is completely finished. And it's not that it wasn't finished, but like Tony painted a new cover for the trade, or for this for the hardcover, which is a design he's had around for a long time because he had wanted to use it for the DC trade, but DC, I guess, didn't get the emails. But by that point, they weren't asking us. But so he's had the basic image forever, but he did it's a full painting. I mean,
That's awesome.
So he finished the painting, and then there's the process because it's not just a small. You know, he had to scan it and. And so we were going to launch today. As soon as that came in, he scanned it, came in later. Scan wasn't great. So, I mean, that's literally where we are. We're like, let's just make sure we have all our ducks in a row. Yeah. So So he's trying to figure out, you know, he wants to get the best image he can from that. And everything else is in place. So it should go up tomorrow at some point. So there's, you know, tomorrow will be the first order. Cool. And they came in. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, all I was going to ask was, I don't know if you want to talk about this yet until it's live, but once it does go live, what can people expect from it? Obviously, they're going to get the book if they pledge, but what else will be available? Or is that secret until it launches?
I mean, just in general terms, and I'm going to... from Tony and my perspective, I don't think we knew exactly what we were going to do with the material or the character once we... got the rights back. I'd kind of mentioned it to him a few times because it's there, it exists. It's been 10 years. I was surprised when I mentioned it that people who had followed me on Facebook or whatever, you know, who'd read all of my work, who this seemed to be right up their alley. I had some people tell me they'd never heard of them. How did I miss that? You know? And so you never know. As a comic creator, most comic creators seem to shy away from like promoting and pushing their stuff. I mean, we have this constant conversation about, well, I'm sorry if I'm shoving this down your throat, you know, to people who are following them because they're fans of their work. And I'm always like, I mean, that's why I'm following people whose work I enjoy. I want to know what they're doing. Yeah. But so like this Zoop, who handles everything beyond the actual work, which is... just amazing. That's how, you know, they are the ones who were like, hey, you should do Comic Book Club. You know, I used to be a PR, like I was the PR and marketing coordinator for Image for a year. So I've had my time doing PR in the industry and all this, but I still am like, well, you want me to do I'm going to do another interview. You know, and then I realized there's not that much. It's just such, I don't know why it's so hard to get saturated. I mean, you know, very few people are going to say, well, I've heard too much about that. I'm not going to buy that. It's a whole psychological thing with comic.
Well, creators. That was one ad too much. No, thank you. I'm
good. Yeah,
that's exactly.
Wait, I mean, I've read my tweet limit. I can't handle one more.
I was talking to
situation.
I don't know if you guys are familiar with Jeremy Hahn's work, but he's an artist and writer who's done lots of great things. And he's been on a tour for a Boom book that he's doing, like a book tour. And it was funny because the first thing we ever crowdfunded was a thing called Bad Karma, which was like this 200 page, back there. It's 200 page hardcover. I was gonna grab one of the two I have left, but,
you got a lot of amazing stuff. It looks like back there.
You got a lot of shit in
very,
here. That's
very
sure.
Cool. Creative space that you have there. Yeah, go grab it. Let's see.
This was the first thing we did, right? And let me tell you something. Here's the thing about comic creators, the ones who aren't shy. So you see this when a couple years after this came out, we'd have it on tables and people would say, oh, you guys ripped off Jonathan Hickman's East. Well, this was Jonathan Hickman designed this cover for us. And then used this design for his book after the fact. He was like, I mean, Hickman is the smartest guy in comics. And, you know, we'd be like, well, no, it's actually, you know, but John's like, wait, we didn't pay him anything in fairness. Can be honest about it. So
yeah,
he's like, well, I might as well, you know, anyway,
that's so funny. It's great. It becomes part of the story.
Yeah. But, so, I can't remember. Oh, So yeah, Alex Grecian is a writer who is a novelist who's also a comic book writer. Did Proof at Image, and he's done Rasputin at Image. He was one of the four creators that kind of made up Bad Karma. Myself, Jeremy Hahn, Alex, and Seth Peck, who's a writer. And Jeremy was going all over to all these shops and doing this. And Alex, as a novelist, said, and he's going to, he said, it's almost like you're on a book tour. And then he immediately backed up and he said, I'm sorry, you are on a book tour. And it's like, and I kind of, I said, oh, comics. And you know, I want, I'm like, I'm joking, but that is kind of, you have to remind yourself, that's what we're doing. There's no reason we can't promote our shit like other people promote their stuff.
Yes.
Absolutely. So Zupa's been great with that. Yeah.
And if you, it's funny you're saying some people haven't read the original. Like, what a perfect book to sort of unearth for people, because it has that like weird tales quality to it, and that like sort of discovery, like almost like this is too fucked up back in the day, or like the arts get so crazy. Like, it's really nice.
I mean, I hope so. I hope it resonates with. Speaking, you know, the problem with all of this is that it's about reaching people who you know would be interested in it, because it is a kind of book that I think might fall. And I think a lot of the stuff with my creator-owned books kind of works like this, because I'm not doing straight, you know, superhero books all the time or what have you. You're always like Hawaiian Dick had this sort of, you know, we called it tiki noir, right? So there's a whole culture of tiki aficionados. I mean, like a big community, you know, they have conventions and so immediately back in the day, that was one of the first like secondary communities I matriculate. I'm a fan of all that stuff, but it just feels like there's so many people out there that would enjoy what we're doing, but we just are in this little bubble where we're just talking to each other all the time. So to your point, I think this is a book that if somebody's willing to read comics and they have any affinity for weird stuff, noir, pulp, you know, horror on a, you know, it's not on a massive scale, but creepy shit. They don't have to have any frames of reference in terms of comics to enjoy it. Hopefully that happens to some degree.
Well, I definitely enjoyed it back in the day, and I'm very excited that you're bringing it back. Before we let you go, though, what else are you working on? Anything else you want to plug in particular, or is it just focused on Whistling Skull all the time?
No, because the Whistling Skull came up. Tony and Zoop a couple months ago were like, hey, you know, and we had to do so little work to get it done that it promoting it is, you know, and over the next month or so, I'll be talking a lot about it. I mean, the last thing I did, I have two, like this you may still be able to find Miles to Go, which is a book I did at Aftershock that I'm very happy with and proud of. Again, it's a spy high concept assassin book with rooted in family relationships. What I'm trying to do better, even though it's always been kind of one of my focuses, is use genre to tell bigger stories or more personal stories. You know, Tony, not to ramble on, but Tony Harris and James Robinson did Starman in the 90s, which was probably the book that kept me reading comics when I was in college.
Same.
Because, you know, I'm glad the kids enjoyed the, and as somebody who's done a lot of Image work, whatever, but you know, you know what I'm saying? It was the Extreme era and all that stuff. It was fun, but so like things like Starman in terms of genre, there were a lot of independent and, you know, Acme Novelty Library, you know, and all this stuff, Dan Klaus and all that stuff. But in terms of superhero comics, to have that book, which was so against the grain and really taught me that you could tell genre superhero stories, but also make them about character and other things and not lose that, you know? So getting to create this book with Tony, because that book was so seminal, and becoming friends with James Robinson, the writer, who has always been super complimentary of my work. And I realized at one point that it's because we like our Venn diagrams are on top of each other. You know, I'm like, I used to be so flattered, but then I'm like, well, that's because we do, like, we have the exact same frames of, you know, it's like sometimes, right. Yeah, it's like maybe we're the only fans of each other at this point. But, so Miles to Go is that's was out earlier this year, I think. I did a graphic novel from Insight Comics that COVID delayed and what have you, but it came out in June called Endless Summer with Shane White. Yeah. It's a 60s youth culture spy, not spy, but FBI is involved. And then after that, right now what I'm working on is an artist named Mac Chater, who recently just did a Stranger Things thing, and he did Briggs Land at Dark Horse. He and I have been working on a political vampire horror thing for since pre-COVID. And that that's scheduled to be out at the end of next summer, where they gave us, the publisher and title and all that stuff hasn't probably been officially announced. So, but they gave us this leeway. So we're going to build this, and we'll have the first installment of that out at the end of the summer. That's a book that we developed before COVID and before like January 6th. And stuff we put in this book that we thought was pushing the boundaries of reality has been trumped by reality. So
literally trumped. It's too fucked up.
I mean, I'm not saying that for political purposes. I'm just saying, I mean, literally, I'm emailing Mac. I'm like, holy shit, you know, this is worse. this is crazier than, and so anyway, it's been funny developing this during the course of things happening that people are going to read the book and think, oh, well, it's a direct analogy. And we're like, no, we had this. Like one of the things Mac and I were talking about was how could the country shut down? I kept thinking, what would paralyze the country? You know, and I was like, I can't think of anything. And my only thought was maybe if the internet was shut down. Well, then shit, COVID hits, and like I'm like, holy shit, the country just shut down, and people, it's like we're this close to Mad Max in a week. You know, I mean, anyway, that book we've really put a lot of.
We got to get that monkey's paw out of your hand, if at all.
I just need to direct it in a different.
Exactly.
Smaller relationships, man. And Mac and I have just sort of developed a rapport. We work together well, and we want to kind of start building a little library after that. So we've actually got a sort of a midnight detective high. It's hard to explain without talking too much about it, but it's kind of noir detective thing, Dark Knight, Columbo meets Rockford Files meets Night Stalkers, sort of. Nice. And it's so
Batman.
It's as
Batman.
It stands, no. it's nice. No, it's I couldn't think of another analogy for bat, so you lost. So
Flying Road.
It's Moon Knight. As it stands right now, I think that's going to be like a series of maybe hardcover graphic novels. You kind of like what Brubaker and Phillips do at Image with their books. I mean, that's actually, I'll be honest, that's kind of who we were as creators. Kind of, we love the way those guys work together and the sheer volume of great things that they've done together. So that's. Those are the two things and I'm sure there's something probably more pressing that I can't think of that someone's waiting on.
Hey, I'm excited about all that stuff. That all sounds awesome. Good luck with Whistling Skull. I'm very excited to check that out too when that launches, hopefully tomorrow. If Tony Harris can get his act together,
yeah,
I guess.
Scan that shit, Tony. What?
Yeah, come on.
Well, he posted a photograph of it on Facebook, but he sent the scans, and I was like, wow, did you really paint that dark? And then he immediately replied and said, oh, that scan looks like shit. I got to fix it. And then on Facebook, he had like taken a picture with his phone that was perfect. And I'm like,
use that. We got to launch. Come on.
I was glad to see it, because I was like, okay, I knew that's what it was. You know, I didn't want to. Yeah. I'm like, really? Did we want it to look like mud? But it looks fantastic as the painting. So hopefully that comes together. But yeah.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, definitely looking forward to it. Congratulations in advance, and thank you so much for coming on. It was a pleasure chatting.
Thanks for having me, guys. Hope I didn't ramble too much, but
no, that's great, what I'm doing.
Good stuff.
All right, you said Starman. I was happy.
The Last Kids on Earth and their superhero alter egos are back in the latest installment of the graphic novel spinoff series, The Last Comics on Earth, Too Many Villains. Jack, June, Quint, and Dirk face their biggest challenge yet, creating the sequel to their hit graphic novel in a mad dash, puzzle-filled race across Apocalyptia to stop the biggest evil plan in history. Hey, you know what the creators of Last Comics on Earth's evil plan is? Make me and my kids love these books. Seriously, my younger kid is a huge fan of both the Last Kid series and the Last Comic series.
It's true.
And now I'm hooked too. The whole team has created a delightful cast of characters with some fantastic kid-friendly art throughout that will appeal to readers of all ages. Buy your copy of The Last Comics on Earth in stores today. You can also visit lastkidsonearth.com to learn more. There we go. All right, once again, it's The Whistling Skull. It's coming out from Zoop very soon, possibly tomorrow as we're taping, but I guess we'll see. And that was B. Clay Moore. And now we're going to move on to our next section, which is my favorite section because you all make it up. It's your audience question. And for audience questions, all you got to do is drop a question, ask a question here on Crowdcast or in the comments over on YouTube, and we will get to them. But first, what is everybody drinking tonight? I know that Brett Macris, a.k.a. Stray Bullet,
Stray
a.k.a.
Bullies.
Stray Bullies, a.k.a. CBC Chef, designed a drink based on a potato and Nat Townsend tonight, but is very sick. I did not make that, unfortunately. I'm sorry. It seemed like a delicious drink, but what are you guys drinking?
Variation on the hot toddy, which is very good. Just not something I can sit down at my laptop and drink two of. I'm drinking some red wine. I sort of got a nice bottle for myself, a Pomerol.
Ooh, looks fancy.
Yeah, very fancy. Loving it.
Is your wife gonna get pissed you're drinking the good stuff? You know what I mean? I mean, that looks expensive, man.
Yeah, don't tell her. This is the one place I'm pretty solidly sure she won't find out.
Pete, what about you? What are you drinking?
Oh, man, only the top of the line for me, bro. Look at this right here, huh? Mm. My brother's fridge, speaking of, you know, we've got to be cool about this. My brother's fridge is getting down to, it was this or Budweiser, so I went with the light.
And you went with Miller Lite.
Yeah.
I'm drinking a Southern Tier 2X Citrus
beer. That means two times.
It does mean two times. It is 8.2% alcohol by volume.
Alex. So,
woo!
Oh, there boy.
But it's pretty delicious. It's like basically like orange grapefruit soda beer. Very good stuff.
Nice.
There we go. Why don't we get
simultaneously
to some questions?
Old and young, as always.
Lost me a grapefruit.
All right, let's get to some questions here. This is from Edward Doherty. Alan Moore is an old grump, but mainstream comics have probably never been closer to legitimate art than when he was active. I recently found a quote from him and wanted your response. During an interview, he was asked what he thinks of the current corp of comics creators. He said, a generation of fan artists and writers who were brought in as kind of scab labor because they would have paid to write Batman. Despite the wording, do you think there's something to the incestuous nature of fans writing to appeal to fans who became fans after reading what other fans wrote?
Who?
Wow.
Once again, it's us versus Alan Moore. Go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, I think that like where his argument falls apart is you got to, you know, kind of once you're in the door, you then kind of have to prove yourself and write great stuff to kind of keep that going. So I can understand like catering, you know, you're writing to something is maybe not the best. You kind of want to write in your voice and kind of, you know, people want to hear your kind of take on things. But, you know, I mean, the people get jobs a lot of different ways. You know, I think it's, you know, once you do get the job, however you get it, you know, what do you do with it and how good is it? That's really what you should be judging on. But that's just my take.
I mean, I think comics from almost the very beginning were mashing up and taking what came before and finding something new. In fact, I think that's what Alan Moore is sort of is best known for, is taking the superhero genre, you know, mixtaping it up and then elevating the whole thing with like more mature themes and like diving deeper into characters. So I think he is a little bit grumpy in general. I'd be curious if he really dug in and read some stuff. There's just so many more comics now, so maybe he just needs to be pointed.
Well, that was the thing
hits.
That I was going to bring up, as not to pull the geek card on Alan Moore, but what's the last comic that he read? Like, I'm just curious. I would love to hear from him. Is he picking up Chip Zdarsky's Batman and he's like, oh, this is a bunch of trash? I sincerely doubt it. I don't think Alan Moore has read comics in a very long time. But, and I agree with what both of you guys are saying, but I do think, like we kind of touched on here and like he's touching on, there is a kernel of truth in terms of once you get far enough afield of something, you do have fans writing about the thing. I always think about The Simpsons. I think that's one of the best examples of that, of like, the first couple of seasons of The Simpsons where they're figuring it out. Conan O'Brien came on as the showrunner and it hit its heyday from, I don't know, season 3 through 7 or something like that, whatever it is.
Yes.
And then
Monorail.
Monorail, sure. And then you had years later, maybe a decade later when the show's still running, you have people who grew up being like, oh my God, I love The Simpsons. I can't believe it. This is my dream job. I'm writing for The Simpsons. So they're basing that stuff on the fact that they love The Simpsons. So there is a photocopy quality to what's going on. But particularly with comics, I think like you were touching on a little bit, Justin, and I think also getting to the point that you were making, Pete, there's a broad enough span of comics that, yes, that even if that's true for 90% of it, there's still that 10% that is pushing things forward and challenging things in some way. And I think that's true of any discipline. When you look at anything, 90% of it is bad to fine to pretty good. And then there's like 10%, and that's being generous, that's brilliant. And that's fine. Like, that's how it works out.
Well, and like I would challenge, like, is Alan Moore repping 100% of the comic book industry from when he was working? Or is he repping the 10%, like you're saying, that is still, there's still a good 10% of comics that are revelatory and looking forward, but he's just not seeing that that's sort of always been the formulation.
Well, and he's also mostly asked about, so this is probably what he's talking about, superhero comics. He's not talking about what's happening at Image Comics or Top Shelf or anything like that, where there are people who are really challenging conventions and format or figuring out things. You know, there, even when you go to mainstream comics, there's always something that breaks through in a big way. We've talked about this on the show before, but Matt Fraction and David Aja's Hawkeye, just on a base structural level, created a new way of doing language in comic books that impacted everybody and still impacts people to the day. Or, Pete, I know you don't like this, but Jonathan Hickman's X-Men was super impactful, clearly.
Yeah, we're still in that shithole.
Not just with the X-Men, but with things in Marvel, things in DC, things in Image Comics, the way of mixing up text pages and ancillary information in the middle of the book is something that people have gotten very excited and glommed onto. And I don't think you can't dismiss that, you know?
Yeah, because it's like, man, you know what's better than reading a comic? Reading a novel. Let's put more of the novel in the comic. You know what I mean?
Uh-oh, Grump Alert, we've got our own Alan Moore on staff here.
Well, and to be clear, Pete has been as revelatory and impactful in the comic book industry as Alan Moore, so I think it's fair for him to say that.
Well, we got a question sort of the here. Pete's the Alan Moore of TikTok now, so that's
Oh my God.
Yeah, Pete, you should check him out on TikTok. He's laying down those dance moves and fat beats.
That's not true.
I'm old. All right, here we go. This is a question from YouTube. Steve Kwasniewski, I really messed that up. Sorry, Steve. Says, in the bio of his new book of stories, this is a follow-up. In the bio of his new book of stories, Alan Moore describes himself as the best and most influential writer in the history of comics. Maybe he's being a little glib. I don't know.
Yeah.
There you go. And Pablo asks, you guys have TikTok now. Yes, we do. TikTok, check us out. Comic Book Club Live. We do actually have a TikTok. There you go.
We're too old.
Nothing wrong with having a TikTok. Another show I do is called Characters Welcome, and I do the Characters Welcome.
Hey, don't blog your other stuff right now.
It's nice.
And not to blow up your spot, Pete, you asked to do a video, and it's very cute. It's Pete, like, he's holding a towel in front of him. He jumps a couple of times, and the towel disappears, and he's wearing a bikini, but it's just a split second. So you kind of like.
I don't know how he did it. It's amazing.
Yeah.
That's not what I'm doing.
It's very sexy. Don't own it, Pete. This is from
Stop
Kevin.
Lying What's... to people to get views.
Pete, don't take your name off your TikTok.
To get just views, to you think Alan me Moore. Saying you in a bikini is going to get views for our TikTok versus people avoiding it as much as possible? I'm sorry, Harry man. This is from Kevin. What's a Marvel or DC story you'd want to see redone as an unrelated comic without the Marvel or DC elements?
Ooh, nice.
Ooh. Secret Wars. I'd love to see just a bunch of guys fighting on a planet.
Hey, watch the news, man.
No, watch the news. Check out the news, bro.
I think that's called regular war, Alex.
Yeah, regular war.
Secret war.
Yep.
I mean, that's a tough... I'm trying to think of, like, the... Some of the Alan Moore stuff. Some of the, like, classic... what was the Superman story? What do you get for the man who has everything? Or if that's not the, quite mm-hmm. the right title, but the blossom that grows in out of your heart and
awesome blossom, yeah,
awesome blossom, yeah,
yeah,
definitely blooming onion, the blooming
yeah.
onion,
that yeah, grows yeah, blooming onion, right? They put a fried onion on Superman's chest and he goes and eats it.
I think for me, it's Marvel Zombies.
So you'd
that's
like
just a zombie. Regular zombie movie.
great. Wow. This is giving great
deeply
answers,
insightful answers.
Yeah.
Yes. This last one here is from Stray Bullet. If you could bring back a character who has seemingly fallen away into oblivion and people have forgotten about, who would you bring back? Jack Knight? Cypher? Stray Bullet's being mean, Cypher, but Cypher is vitally important to the X-Men franchise right now.
Yeah, he sits on the tree and is like, I'm in charge of this sexual island.
Mm-hmm. He talks to the tree.
He's like, I speak for the trees.
He does.
He does. He speaks literally for the trees.
Yes.
Jack Knight Starman is one that there's a new Stargirl book that just came out today. And I love seeing elements of this character that I love. But now the Cosmic Rod basically talks, which is not what I want to see. So I would like to see some classic Starman brought back, even though that story was well told and fully finished.
Yeah.
I bet James Robinson will come back for one.
You think so?
Well, because, I mean, Starman's all about nostalgia and legacy and about, like, fathers and sons. And I think the book ended with him having a kid. And mm-hmm. so I do think there's a lot of potential there for legacy and an aging Jack Knight and what that all means.
Yeah. All right, and that is it for your audience questions. We're going to move on with our next section, which is trivia, and for that, we're going to turn it over to Pete LePage.
All right. Well, this is the part we give back to you, the lovely audience. It's an opportunity to win $25 free to Midtown Comics or Long John Silver for some reason.
Oh, and Pete added it. We got him.
And so it's just, you want to be first hand up guy on YouTube or on Crowdcast.
Yeah, just
here.
Say me or hand up or anything like that. We'll bring you into the stream if you're on Crowdcast. If you're over on YouTube, you can just say me and we'll do it in the comments. It'll be very awkward and terrible, but we'll do it anyway.
Yeah, we'll do it anyway.
Just like Long John Silver.
Yep.
Yeah.
Just like eating it, Long John Silver.
Straight bullets.
Wow, we got a shout out. Yeah.
Nat should do it. Nat's sick.
I think Nat is less sick now, but we have to see. He sometimes steps away from his computer in the middle of the show.
Or do you guys want to do it? We'll just
sure, we can do it. We can do it for a charity.
Yeah, there you go.
Maybe should we donate to old Warnock over there?
Down for it.
Yeah, there we go.
Raphael, Warnock for Senate. He's cool but rude. Please vote for the cool but rude candidate.
Why don't we do that? We're going to do it for him because it would be really nice to, I know Democrats already have a majority, not majority. They have majority. Is it majority in the Senate?
Well, because of the tie-breaking vote, this would be the 51st. Right. So there would be no tie-breaking.
It'll give them a little buffer room for the whole cinema thing.
Yeah. Nice.
All right. Really, let's do it. Yeah. We're going to donate $25 to that. Take it away, Pete.
All right, today's trivia is on topical comic news and a small nod to the legend, Kevin Conroy. R.I.P. Best
Thank
Batman.
You. I was literally going to lose my mind if you didn't do that, Pete.
Well, there was a lot of people who died, dude. All right? It's been crazy.
I know. I let him jump the line, so thank you for letting him jump the line. Do we want to mention that really quick? Yeah. I know we put up a video on YouTube, but Kevin Conroy shockingly passed away late last week. I'm going to turn off the music here.
Although it does feel a little Batman-esque.
Yeah, I'm going to put away the trivia music. So Kevin Conroy came on our live show twice, I think. And we may have interviewed him at least one or two more times. Obviously, like, we didn't know him on a personal basis or anything like that, but we did spend a couple of hours with him, and he was a lovely human being. He was a lovely, like, earnest, few people in my life I think I've met that is, like, seems like exactly what he is. Like, he loves Batman, and he loves the fans, and he loved doing what he was doing, and that was all on display.
But also sometimes when people kind of like rise, you know, they kind of rise above it a little bit. You know what I mean? Like, they've been in movies and television and all sorts of things. So if you want to have a talk show that we put together on the fly, they're not really down for, you know what I mean? The fact that, like, we were like, would it be cool? Like, we think this would be funny. And he was game for it. Like, he was willing to, you know, swear in the Batman voice and open up and tell his 9/11 story, which we went on to share with other people. But, like, it was amazing the first time we heard that. And just the fact that, you know, he was very professional and had an amazing background and was an unbelievable classically trained actor, still was super goofy and would let us see that side of him, was, you know, just not putting on airs or fronts or being like, I'm only this. It was just super amazing to work with somebody who was that on such a level, also willing to kind of play with us. It was just very, very moving, and it just made him so much cooler on top of all the other amazing things he had accomplished in his life.
Well, I think what you said about him being like, he was an actor's actor, you know, he, like, when he wanted to come hang out with us, it was like, yeah, let's put on a show and he wanted to just be in front of the fans. And that was very cool. The way we got connected to him is a comedian I went to college with, and we were on the improv team at Hamilton College, Selena Kopic, is Kevin's cousin. And so she randomly was like, hey, I know you're doing this. And this was sort of in our earlier days of doing Comic Book Club. She's like, hey, I saw you're doing this comic book thing. My cousin is the voice of Batman. Would that be something we were... I was like, oh my God, how did we not? yes. And it was so cool. I texted her immediately when I saw the news online. And she was very upset. He was only 66, like, very young to die. Left behind his husband, who is, like, distraught, but really, like, loving all the attention that Kevin's getting since he passed. So keep it going if you're still feeling it out there. And the thing I want to say about him from my perspective is, like, it's crazy. He is a defining voice of one of the most popular characters in all of culture. Like, his voice, and there have been so many versions of Batman and so many bigger budget versions and much more recent versions, but pound for pound, he's the voice of Batman, specifically Bruce Wayne, and, like, in through the humanity of Bruce Wayne that he brought to that character and made the animated series and all the other versions of animated Batmans that he played just resonate so hard and connect hard. Batman, a character that I think is sometimes, especially in the feature films, you're like, I don't really connect with it. I like watching it and it's the action's good, but I'm not connecting with this character. And he brought that every single time he said the words. And it's just such a one of those losses that you're like, you feel your shoulders sink because you're like, oh, I won't have that. Selfishly, I won't have that anymore.
Also, it was really interesting to see, like, Mark Hamill talk about, like, his connection with him and how he helped shape the Joker, and because he was such an amazing Batman that really led to things that he found with the Joker, that just things that I didn't know that just kind of blew me away. That was just such an unbelievable. I was like, oh yeah, of course. Like, but just just so amazing, so sad.
Yeah, just one other thing that I wanted to bring up that Justin, you mentioning what you just did reminded me of, not to bring up our TikTok again, but I did post the video of his appearance, which was taken by Tom Radar back in the day, used to like just
the show. Spidey 616?
Spidey 616 had videotaped the show, and I'm so glad he did, because Nerdist took down the video of our show, so that's not available, but his video is still available. So I excerpted the 9/11 story and put it up on TikTok. The majority of the comments, we got a ton of comments on it, and people being like, I'm so sad, rip Kevin Conroy, etc. But like good 50% of the comments were when I read Batman comics, the voice that I hear is Kevin Conroy's voice. Yeah, so obviously he's gone. It's awful that he's gone, but it really does feel like he's going to live on for everybody forever through every iteration of Batman. And that's incredible.
Yeah, I went down a real Batman the Animated Series hole after he died, and I haven't come out yet. So anyway, all right, guys, please listen to all three options before making your selection, okay? Here we go. Question number one, and I saw Zalb's tweeted about this, but I'd already started working on this question, so I don't want anybody to feel that there's a connection here. Who is making her Marvel Comics? I did not. How dare you? I was first. You fucking
topical as Alex tweets for you, right, Pete? That's where you get your news.
Yeah, I always go to the same place, but it wasn't. It's not Alex's tweets. All right, who's making her Marvel Comics debut with Scarlet Witch number one coming out in January, written by Steve Orlando? Is it A, Lewis Darcy, B, Darcy Lewis, or C, John Ratzenberger? I'm not giving you guys hints on this.
I didn't.
It's also crazy that you're like, Alex tweeted about it, probably cheated. Only one of these answers ever would make sense in a million years. Darcy Lewis, right?
You are correct, sir.
The character from the MCU.
Cat, come on. You know I'm on it. All right, here we go. Question number two. JT4 will be bringing back what Substack comic to Dark Horse? Obviously, when I say JT4, I'm talking about James Tynion IV. Is it A, Tiny Onion, B, Long Shallot, or C, Shelley Long?
You could be talking about John Turturro, just to mention.
That's true. I thought you meant my four sons in succession from me would be JT4.
We're not there.
Is that what
yet,
you mean?
Buddy. Nope. You got all girls.
Tiny Onion. I'm going to say Tiny Onion. Tiny Onion?
Yep, you are correct.
That makes sense.
Great. Okay. There we go.
Great. All right. Here we go. Last one. In honor of Kevin Conroy, the 2020 Pride issue with his story in it is now free on which platform? Is it A, the DC website, B, Where George, or C, George Went?
I'm going to... Great question.
You're losing it. You're losing it, dude. You're like really.
I gotta say, the DC website.
You are correct. Yeah, if you go to the DC website right now, you can see the Pride issue number one. The 2020 is free for everybody now, and it's got his story in there, and it's a great issue. So it's a win-win for everybody.
Wow, Raphael Warnock out in our audience, he watches live every week, is probably pumping his fist in joy right now. Yeah, got that $25
on the race
gift card to Long John Silver is coming his way.
He wants the gift card.
Do you guys know what TV show or movie I'm talking about?
I'm going to guess the TV show, since you never say TV show otherwise, except for right now you said TV show.
You're going to say Batman the Animated Series?
No.
What is
Shelley Long, George Went? Come on. What were we talking
Cheers?
About? Yeah, he was on two episodes of Cheers.
Hilarious.
Wow. I didn't know that. It was really cool.
An actor. He's an actor's actor.
Oh, yeah, for sure. It was fun to see a bunch of his old stuff that I've been going down a rabbit hole with. But,
Kevin in the comments roasting you, saying, I don't think Shelley Long was still on Cheers when he guested.
It said his episode she was in there. So, fuck you, Kev.
Wow. As we all know, nude comic books are coming out all the time. What are you guys looking forward to? Pete,
did you say nude comic books are coming out all the time?
Yeah, they got no covers or anything. I go in, I rip the covers off, and I'm like, hello.
Don't hurt the art.
Hello.
Speaking of ripping covers, Shirtless Bear Fighter number 2, number 4, and then Something is Killing the Children number 26 is what I'm looking forward to.
Great. Justin, what about you?
I enjoyed a lot of books that we will be talking about in the near future.
Oh, yeah?
Chroma number 1 from Image Comics, in a post-apocalyptic world where monsters sense color. So all the humans that survive have to erase any sort of color. Really going to enjoy that. Got to give a shout out to Nightwing number 98, which is, I don't know how this book can change tones as much as it does and still be fantastic, but it is.
I will give a shout out to I Hate Fairyland number 1. I was very interested to check that out from Scotty Young and Brett Bean. This is a return to the classic Scotty Young series about a girl named Gert who is sucked into Fairyland and can't escape and goes steadily insane and murders everybody. Now she's
back. As you would.
So excited to see that return. Excited to see what the new story is. All of those titles are going to be in our Stack podcast that comes out Wednesday at 9 a.m. in the Stack feed and also the Comic Book Club feed. And folks, that is it for this week's show.
Yeah.
A couple of people we want to thank. We want to thank Sean Jackson for coming on. Check out Marvel Mazes out right now from Chronicle Books.
Please
also
do.
Beat Clay Moore for coming on. Check out on Zoop. Yeah. The Whistling Skull should be live very soon. Next week, we're going to have Mike Davenport here. He's the lead writer and creative director for Marvel Universe Online, a fan-created Marvel Universe RPG. Very curious to talk more about that. Should be very interested. Also, The Doom Room, our Doom Patrol podcast. Check that out every Thursday. Marvel Vision, our Marvel podcast. Bunch of episodes coming up soon, including Wakanda Forever. I promise that is coming. We are going to tape it. Patreon.com/comicbookclub. Support this show and all the shows we do. Subscribe on Apple, Android, Spotify, forever. Stitcher, or the app of your choice at Comic Book Live on Twitter, Comic Book Club Live on Instagram, Comic Book Club Live on TikTok, comicbookclublive.com for this podcast and many more. Until next time, good night.
Take care of yourself.
Yeah, babe. Later.